Accession number 25436, Real One.
At that stage, it was the 512 Company RASC, and we were sent out to India, where we became attached to an Indian unit in transit to Burma. The Burma line at that stage was apparently being held, so they threw us, or they sent us up the Gulf to Iraq and Persia. And we were stationed just half a day away from Baghdad at an oasis or oasis called Nasaib. From there, we had to journey backwards and forwards from Basra to the Caucasus via Persia. We were covered as foreign troops, of course, in that part of the world, and we weren't too welcome because they were pro-German, and the Germans were in occupation prior to. But we used to load at Basra half tracks and bring gun carriers, and then take 12-14 days to get up to the Caucasus via the Persian oil hills. So it meant changing from clothing of necessary for 120 degrees of heat to clothing for 18 below zero in the Persian oil hills. And it was a rough ride, a very rough ride. The roads weren't, it was all track, and the hills were, the track was just hewn out of the hills, which we had to surmount. It's a job to recall all that happens, but we used to go via Hilla, Massoud, Baghdad, Kermanshah, Tehran, up into Tabriz, where the Russians took from us the armaments that we took up with us, of course, that we convoyed. And it wasn't a very pleasant ending to a real rough journey, because the Russians would only let you go into a perimeter, which was heavily guarded by women, huge women, who let you know that they were the governors, and you spent just 24 hours resting there. They provided us with very, very little, and I don't suppose they had much anyway. And at that stage we turned around and spent the next 10 or 11 days journeying back.
How many miles would this be?
I quite truthfully do forget, but the amazing, I can't remember how far is Basra from the Caucasus at this stage. I did know, but the amazing thing that used to happen to us, very often you'd be in the middle, 2 days out into the middle of the Iraqi desert, and all of a sudden you come across a coachload of people going apparently nowhere. Now, in those days, it was a company, and probably still they run, I don't know, the Nairn Coach Company, and they used to travel from London all the way down to Baghdad. It was a connecting coach from London, obviously, to the coast and then France, and what was it?
It's surreal. The tourists.
No. This was a coach company that that ran pre-war every twice a week or something like that. Actually, and they'd all be sitting bolt upright in these coaches, you know. And Lord knows where they. Well, I don't say where they came from. They came through Syria, Turkey, and that way, you see. And it was obviously a curtailed service during the war at some stage, but they used to go trans-desert with no signs, or just a wog driver, that's it. And also in the Iraqi desert, you'd find camel trains. They'd take 2 or 3 hours to pass, a whole tribe on the move, and they'd slowly go past. And they were so long, they'd take two or three hours for the whole tribe to pass.
So how secret was your journey then?
Well, at that stage, of course, it was a closed shop, because it was a backdoor supply through to Russia with armaments, be it a very small proportion, of course, but it was an opposite run to the North Sea route. Whilst I was on aid to Russia through the back door at the bottom, my brother was on aid to Russia with the Navy up through to Murmansk. That was rather, rather ironical, really. But unfortunately, we lost a lot of fellas and a lot of trucks on that game.
What due to enemy action or drive?
No, one or two accidents on the hills. Drivers not being able to negotiate the hairpins with the huge trucks that we had, and also who they were, we never did find out. But there was always someone up there rolling boulders down, and. We were never too happy, but fortunately, of course, at that stage there was a time limit on the duration of stay, so of course they brought us back for this D-Day stunt. Two extended to 3 years. It was a very hot situation, but. We had white trucks and Scammels and Macs, some with trailers, and it was one long haul all the time.
Did you see any enemy action then, there?
No, not until we left and came through Transjordan, Syria into Africa. And we just got in on the back end of that, and then they carted us off to...
So it was a secret operation. It worked?
It worked. Oh, yes, it worked very, very well. Very, very well. There were few white troops there. There were what white units there were attached to Indian divisions. And we had Indian guards.
So if anybody had come across you in the desert, what were you supposed to do?
Well, there were sufficient of us. You see, there'd be at least 60 trucks. We'd have Indian outriders anyway, on their Bengal carriers, scout cars and whatnot.
And if they did see you, what impression would they have? Ah, there goes a group of soldiers, or gosh, they must have something in there.
Well, I suppose within the area, it was basically known, but it was never it was never talked about or spoken about, or it was so far as the rest of the world concerned, it wasn't really going on, you know.
How many arms do you think you took?
That's a job to say. That's an awful job to say. We used to take two half tracks. Two half tracks in the truck and one on the trailer. So you could say 100 odd per journey. And
did your bosses give you the impression that you were doing something absolutely vital?
Oh yes.
Can you measure it? Or is it just an impression?
No. No, it's just an impression. We had some very good officers. They were all long-serving officers, and they were only concerned with output. They weren't concerned with... well, of course, it doesn't happen anyway in war. In war atmosphere, you don't get any nonsensical parades and find something to keep them busy with. It was a case of there's 24 hours, and we've got to get the maximum work out of those 24 hours.
Was it only arms you took, or anything else?
Purely armaments. No, the only, and plus the spares, of course. Every third half track had a load of spares in it, but we took nothing else. No, nothing else at all. Only unless it was on the side, private, you know. Bring a box of dates up with your tummy next time you come, you know, this sort of thing.
And you'd trade it for the vodka, would you?
Yeah, all sorts of trade, all sorts of situations. Like that. In actual fact, you didn't, of course, see the old 4-gallon petrol cans, but before the jerry can stage, they were about 4 feet by 2 feet square, and the Iraqis used to pack them with dates, these second-hand petrol tins, and we'd take those dates up with us into give them 10 Victory V cigarettes from one of these cans of dates, and at the other end we'd get anything from a watch to a dinar, which was a pound, there was all sorts of those things going there. Quite legitimate, really. You know, we weren't breaking any...
Apart from the dates, what did you eat?
Australian cans of butter. Canadian cans of beer. biscuits. Fresh meat, which we used to be able to purchase as and when the unit stopped near a place where there was any mountain goats or mountain sheep or whatnot. And, of course, they had to be killed and consumed within the same sun. They weren't allowed to be kept overnight. We had fruit from various places on the way because it was always an oasis where we stopped at anyway, where fruit and vegetables were grown in small amounts. But it was, generally speaking, army issue hardtack that we had to put up with.
But it seems to be quite a regular way of life then, was it? I mean, it was a regular routine, this trip.
Yes, it went on. We did it for over 2 years, backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, backwards. It wasn't just a one-off. We used to get fish from Baghdad, which everybody slated and called it tigerist salmon. It was just a white, coarse fish.
Why do you think you remember it so well then? Was it a very important time to you?
I think it was important because one went into it to start with the you've heard this so often, of course, with the old adage that it's only going to be for 6 months, let's get it over with. And gradually it drags on. And the more it drags on, the more you become intoned into the... It's like being in hospital. You become hospitalised. If you have a long stay in hospital, probably you have or you haven't, I don't know. But the day that you're suddenly confronted with the door and discharged, you think to yourself, oh, my goodness, what's going to happen, you know? No more being waited on. And I think the forces are to some degree like this. You have a long spell in the forces. You become activated into it. And you forget that there's anything else. You totally forget. You accept everything that comes. Be it unpleasant, you still accept it. Otherwise no one would go on, would they? They're not driven. There's no one behind them with a gun at the back saying, you've got to go forward and forward and forward. Everybody says, grumbles like hell and gets up and carries on and looks for the end of the road that is forever lengthening, really.
So, between the beginning, between the beginning of your trip, your series of trips, and the end, you got pretty skilled at whatever you had to do, the travelling backwards and forwards and all that. You got to know that pretty well, didn't you? You were an expert traveller through the desert.
Yes, one gets to the stage where losing, or missing anything doesn't happen. You get used to looking at the.
So between the beginning of your trip, your series of trips, and the end, you got pretty skilled at whatever you had to do, the travelling backwards and forwards and all that. You got to know that pretty well, didn't you? You were an expert traveller through the desert.
Yes, one gets to the stage where losing, or missing anything doesn't happen. You get used to looking at the, if you're going trans-desert, you get used to looking at the sun and rough navigation, as it were. Every day out there is the same. In Iraq, for example, there's only 2 weeks in the year when it rains. That's the second and third week in January. And it pours, finny. Every other day is the same. Every other day is totally the same. And in that, you grow to know where you are. The sun's just there at midday, or it's 5 o'clock when it's over there, and you south by west, or whatever. Sometimes it's a little bit off-putting. As I say, if you are taking, some of you taking shortcuts, you meet a situation where way in the distance you can see a gold minaret or dome, and it takes some hours before that becomes fact. You know, it shimmers, and you can't be sure whether it is or it isn't. And when eventually you reach it some hours later, you find that, there is suddenly a village or a tribe there with permanent huts. And yet it isn't marked on the map. No way is it dot on the map.
Did they get to know you then, the people you... I mean, if this was a regular route, did you stop at the same oases all the time, so the people got to know it was you again back after 3 weeks?
Yes, but with each oasis, you see, there was an Indian unit. Freely purchasing what they wanted for convoys that came through, you see.
So this was a secret supply line, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. But there was so much on the go during... Everyone was concerned with Burma and Africa. They were the two main... On either side of us. They were the two main worries, Burma and Africa. And no one was bothered about trucks going backwards and forwards from Basra up to... You know, they went by every so many days, but... Even the local people just sat on the haunches and watched it and accepted it. It was only the military that we weren't allowed to talk about it or write about it, of course, or take photographs and we weren't allowed. We weren't allowed to leave back, say, to India or anything like that. Leave had to be taken on the spot in one or two. We could go into Baghdad when passing, but everywhere else was cordoned off, as it were. You know?
But you see, to me, that would be so infuriating, because I would like to know what exactly I was doing. And what effect my little bit was having on the entire war. It didn't bother you?
No, I think if one could have seen the readiness, the willingness with which the Russians accepted that stuff. There was a little piece of paper that they signed, and they were immediately driven away. They were fueled up straight away and driven straight off before our eyes. They were going further up to where they were needed. They wanted them. They were waiting for them. There were all the time hundreds of drivers waiting for scores of half tracks, etc. They were pleased to get them, even if they forgot that they could have made us comfortable for a little while. And one had to look at it another way too. What was a back door for us to take supplies into Russia, had the Germans taken the Caucasus like they wanted, would have been a back door onto our situations behind India to confuse them a bit with the Japanese in front of them in Burma, and another way, of course, into the back door of Africa. It had to be. The Caucasus has had to be held. There was no doubt about that. But you reach a situation, especially when you come back and think. No way would you miss doing it again if the same thing happened. No question. I don't think any one of them would turn around and walk the other way. In all theatres. Do you think so? You've spoken to a good many people.
Yes, it's hard to say, really, because I think there was a sort of sense of unreality. I think it's only after you've mulled it over for 30 years or so that you suddenly look back and think, my God, I did that. I was there. I killed people.
Yes, it doesn't.
When you're there, it's all happening. It's like everything.
Yeah,
some people even forget little details that they only remember when you talk to them.
Well, this is it. You know, I can sit here and I can't remember all the details.
See, it's interesting to know whether you had a sense of pride doing it, or whether you did it because it was a job, or whether you...
Well, out of... there's pride in it. There's pride in it, but out of that, it becomes norm, doesn't it?
Did you feel a sense of danger every time you went out? You got used to it, didn't you?
I don't think you accept danger after the first. What is that type of danger any more than driving from here to London down the M1? You get in your car every day. I assume you still live the other end of the M1. You get in your car every day. You know full well that every day on that roadway there are accidents. There are people killed. It isn't going to happen to you, is it? In uniform, you're doing a job, and you lose one or two of your pals, but it isn't going to happen to you. It's just the same. It's just the same thing. One does a thing that becomes habit, and in that habit, one completely forgets the dangers that.
Do you still think about it a lot?
Yes, I do. I suppose I do. Yes, I belong to the Normandy Veterans, and we have a meeting once a month. And I suppose that recalls some of the skirmishes. But you see, as you say. It isn't until someone talks to you that you remember some of the oddities, but you forget all the rubbish, you forget all the rough stuff. We had a cook's tour, you know, at at the army's expense. I saw most countries other than... I didn't go to Italy. And on the troop ships, we were on P&O. We were on P&O boats for the couple of journeys we made out. We were on the Castle Line coming back. And you were treated as passengers of that line. There was an awful lot, although there was a lot of mistakes made, there was an awful lot of good things in the service. It's amazing what they thought of prior to a landing or an engagement, or even if they slipped up and somebody at the end of the line good, like the unfortunate airborne landing at in Holland. Yeah, but there was still an awful lot of.
I tell you what, I'm going to keep